Again, to mention the resources, Dave has some at the bottom of his session two, as you saw already, he pointed those out. But you may have noticed also the inside back page of the seminar notes has some other resources, some overlap there, and some different ones as well. I want to check those out. You notice, too, that they're each recommended by one of our guys on staff in a maybe specific way. These are books that they've read, used, benefited from, distributed for years. And maybe the two best, if I could recommend two books that are best related to Song of Solomon and sex, it'd be the first two on that list of the resources there. C.J. Mahaney writes a chapter in the second one, Sex and the Supremacy of Christ. It's a lot like the first book. The second book there, edited by Piper and Justin Taylor, that's a bunch of conference talks put into a book and over a several different topics. Singleness is in there. Issues of gender, homosexuality, things like that are in there as well. So maybe one of those books would be a good thing to pick up. All right? Let's do this. Turn, if you would, to Song of Solomon, Song of Songs, chapter 4. I don't want you, but if you read the book this week, if you read Song of Songs like I asked you to do on Sunday, then you may have had an experience like I did. As I studied this more this week, I kind of felt like it was like the election. Politics. The more I study politics, the more I read into any one's candidate's views, the more frustrated I get. Not that I don't know who I'm going to vote for. I know who I'm going to vote for. But when you try to hunt down a possible lie, a possible misleading on either side, either party, boy, it gets frustrating, right? You hear things like they're going to, you know, cut taxes and try to cut the deficit, and you go, wait a minute, that's fuzzy math, right? It doesn't work. You can't cut and cut, and it works to be even. So it's like that with the Song of Songs. The more I studied it this week, the more I read books about it this week, the more frustrated I got because I saw how diverse the different interpretations are. You can almost not find any, not almost, this is true, at least in my experience, you can't find any two commentaries on the Song of Songs that have the exact same interpretation as far as the structure goes and who's speaking when. I couldn't even find two study Bibles that had the exact same dialogue pattern that you might have in yours. And so hopefully you read it this last week and were confused in parts and encouraged in other parts. And you wondered what it's like. And maybe you even looked in more than one Bible and felt even more confused because one Bible had so-and-so saying this, the girl saying this, and then the guy saying it in another study Bible, and you were frustrated. So let me talk about this first before we get to Song of Songs 4. Let me talk about factors involved for a right interpretation if you're following along on the notes. I got three things under this. And we'll just do these things of structure and interpretation pretty quickly. Factors involved for a right interpretation, I already alluded to one. It's knowing who's speaking when. It's tough. Like Ron said, there are three main people involved, I think. But the third person, I don't think, is the three-person view. Let me explain. I think that generally what you have in the book is a dialogue between a man, a woman, and these friends called Daughters of Jerusalem, called a lot of different things. But sometimes the woman of the passage calls on her friends and her friends call back. And it's like an opera. You know, in an opera, two people can be on stage, but if they're at opposite ends of the stage, they don't even have to be talking to each other. They don't have to be presumed to be in the same room with each other necessarily. Remember Fievel the Mouse, the American Tale? You know, they're underneath the same blue sky or something like that. Remember that? That's what comes to mind, how they're somewhere out there underneath the same blue sky. I'm not going to sing it. I'm tempted to, but you know what it is. They're singing the same song even though they're in different places, and because you're the viewer, it works, right? Because you're seeing both of them, it works. You have stuff like that in the Song of Solomon. So I think if you think opera, if you've seen just an opera or you've just seen American Tale with Fievel the Mouse, if you have that kind of thing in mind, it might help the confusion, because we're so woodenly literal, we tend to want to say, wait a minute, no, he wasn't there. Wait a minute, no, she wasn't there. Wait a minute, who are they talking to now? And sometimes these don't have to just be this nice, clean stream. They can be snapshots and vignettes. You have to, secondly, understand the symbolism. Ron talked a lot about that. I won't get into it. That's tough. You should know that it's tough. Some commentators think this symbol means this, and another one will say it means that. And then you have the structure and flow of Song of Solomon, the third thing. And there are three main views about the structure of the book that I think are important. The first is this. The first is that it's 10 to 20 different love poems that have no necessary flow to them whatsoever. They may not even be about the same people. They may not have been written by the same author. There are all kinds of variations within each of these. But generally, here's one approach, is these are just 10 or 20 different love poems. Another approach is that this is basically chronological. This is probably what most of your study Bibles have, that you have this move from pre-marriage to engagement to a wedding, which is usually seen to be in chapter 3. And then in chapter 4, it's usually a wedding night. It's the honeymoon. And then in chapter 5, there's this mysterious problem that everyone wants to know what that's about. But that's the chronological view, that this is pre-marriage, wedding, wedding night, and then sex within marriage and some of the problems along with that. A third approach is that this is all basically within marriage. If you don't think it's all basically within marriage, if you really want to say so cleanly that chapter 3 is a wedding, chapter 4 is a wedding night, you have slight trouble with things like chapter 1, verse 13, where she's saying, lay between my breasts. That's not good dating. That's not good engagement. And those who want, I think, those who want to talk about this being pre-marriage, a lot of the studies that make this pre-marriage in chapters 2 and 3 and into chapter 1 as well, they don't want to talk about why he's laying between her breasts before they're married. It doesn't fit with most of our pastoral counseling. Remember, Ron said that at three different times it says, don't awaken love before it's time. And it's not just at the beginning, it's also at the end. So look at the notes that you have and see the basic outline, the basic structure there. This might help you just to think of it in terms of the chunks, because everyone agrees on what the chunks are. They don't agree on how to define the chunks, but everyone agrees that's a chunk. Everyone agrees that's a chunk. That's a chunk. That's a chunk. Now, figuring out who's saying what in these chunks is tough. Figuring out what these chunks are about, that's tough. But everyone agrees that these are the chunks, and I'll put my interpretation alongside the chunk. I think chapter 1 to the middle of chapter 3 is about their longing. You've got a woman speaking, then you've got a man speaking, then you've got the woman speaking, and then she has a dream where she's looking for him, but he can't be found. Again, I put in parentheses, is that anticipating marriage? It may be, it may not be, but it's longing. In chapter 3, verses 6 to 11, you have them finally uniting. Some think this is the wedding, but whatever it is, it's some kind of uniting, coming together that is big and important. In chapter 4 to just the beginning of chapter 5, you finally have intimacy, what some people think is the wedding night. And then in chapter 5 to the middle of chapter 6, the end of chapter 6, you have what I would call an advance. That is, a man making an advance on his wife sexually, and there's a mysterious separation. If we have time, we'll get to that and look at it, because I think there's some good practical lessons in it, as well as just a good test in trying to understand the book. And then after this mysterious separation, chapter 7, the middle of chapter 8, they finally reunite, and then you have a couple of more songs of praise from the man and from the woman. So note in your notes, the sections of descriptive intimacy are pretty clear here. The chapters 1 and 2, chapters 4 to the middle of chapter 5, in chapter 7 to the middle of chapter 8. Why that's helpful, I think, is if you want to go looking for the intimate bodily descriptions, the praise songs that you have. Praise songs, we think of them as just vertical. These are praise songs, you could say, of their lover, their spouse. If you want to go looking for that material, here's where it is. Chapter 1 and 2, 4 to the middle of 5, and 7 to the middle of 8. And that's what I want to focus on. So, let's talk about learning and applying the matters of marital intimacy. Look at chapter 4 and verse 9. The man speaking here, I believe, "You've stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume than any spice. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like that of Lebanon. You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, with henna and nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes and all the finest spices. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon." And then I think the woman says, "Awake, north wind, and come, south wind, blow on my garden that its fragrance may spread abroad. Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits." He says at the beginning of chapter 5, "I've come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I've gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk." Well, does it sound like anything you've known? Anything you've got to experience? Let's talk about expectations in the bedroom. I think expectations sometimes can be too high. I said it. It's not the only thing I'm going to say, but I think expectations sometimes can be too high. Remember that this is a book. It is the Song of Songs, as Ron said. They probably had some average sex nights. They don't make it into the book, though, right? They don't make it into the book because that doesn't make for the Song of Songs, the romance Song of Songs. Remember that this book is lofty, and it's not Wednesday night. One of you's catching a cold, but the other one's itching, and kids are interrupting, and the dog got on the bed in the middle of it. Expectations can be too high. Some meals, just like sex, some meals are quickies. Some meals are fast food. Some meals are served on paper plates. Some meals are steaks. Now, some expectations can be too low. Expectations can be and usually are too low. We'll see in this book that the woman, I think, grows in her sexual confidence. And I think that means it should be getting better. We should always be pursuing better lovemaking. It's shown over and over again as people do these sociological studies that the women who are having the hottest sex are middle-aged, Protestant, married women. The most orgasms are happening for middle-aged Protestants. I love it. I love that the world thinks, oh, religious people are stuffy. Religious people are empty. Religious people don't really pursue fun. And sex is all this wild and crazy stuff. And maybe it is wild and crazy stuff, but it's behind closed doors and in middle-aged Protestant homes across America, like ours. You should be pursuing intoxication. Pursuing intoxication is one way of thinking about how you should expect things to be. The intoxication of love is described here in Song of Songs as being drunk with wine. I'm drunk on your love. Like you'd get intoxicated and get silly and get out of your mind. You are to be intoxicated with your spouse on a physical and emotional level. It doesn't always happen, but that's what you should be pursuing, and that's what sometimes you should be seeing. Now, let me show you a video that probably half of you have seen, and the other half are going to be offended. This, I think, very comically highlights the tension between expectations being too high and expectations being too low. So what I'm about to show you is a comedy group called Flight of the Conchords. How many of you have seen Business Time? Yeah, I told half of you have already seen it anyway. But we're going to show you it because it's funny, and we're just going to get the whole sex stuff embarrassment out of the way. You can get embarrassed with them, and then I can get up, and what I'll say will be probably pretty easy. But it's funny in that, again, it describes everyday Wednesday night average lovemaking in the average home, and tells us that that's not that far from the truth, and also reminds us you can't do that all the time. You can't. This it should be better than this. Okay, so let's play it. Watch it.
We'll do another song.
That's right, baby. Girl, tonight we're gonna make love. You know how I know, baby? 'Cause it's Wednesday. And Wednesday night is the night that we make love. Tuesday night's the night that we go and visit your mother, but Wednesday night is the night that we make love. 'Cause everything is just right. Conditions are perfect. There's nothing good on TV. Conditions are perfect. You lean in close and say something sexy like, I might go to bed, I've got work in the morning. I know what you're trying to say, baby. You're trying to say, oh yeah, it's business time. It's business time.
What you're trying to say, let's get down to business. It's business time.
It's business. It's business time.
Ooh. Next thing you know, we're in the bathroom brushing our teeth. That's all part of it. That's foreplay. Then you go sort out the recycling. That's not part of it, but it's still very important. Then we're in the bedroom. You're wearing that ugly old baggy t-shirt from that team building exercise you did for your old work. And it's never looked better on you.
Oh, team building exercise 99.
Oh, you don't know what you're doing to me. I remove my jeans, but trip over them because I still got my shoes on. But then I turn it into a sexy dance. Next thing you know, I'm down to just my socks. And you know when I'm down to just my socks, what time it is. It's time for business. It's business time.
It's business. It's business time.
You know when I'm down to just my socks, it's time for business. That's why they call business socks.
It's business. It's business time. Oh.
Making love for two, making love for 2 minutes. When it's with me, you only need 2 minutes, 'cause I'm so intense. 2 minutes in heaven is better than 1 minute in heaven. You say something like,
is that it?
I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say, oh yeah, that's it. Then you tell me you want some more. Well, I'm not surprised. but I'm quite sleepy.
It's business, it's business time.
Business hours are over, baby.
It's business, it's business time.
How many of you wondered if they had a camera inside your house? Well, a good example, I think, a comical example of expectations being too high, being too impressed with yourself, thinking perhaps that that is never normal. On the other hand, thinking that's normal all the time is horrible, and it's not consistent with Song of Solomon. So let's talk about the second thing here, anticipation of the bedroom. Let's talk about anticipating the bedroom, and a lot of what I'm going to say here is more of the... It's more of a sensual, romantic version of what Dave just talked about. And what Dave just talked about, I'm not in any way easily dismissing. I'm presuming it. I'm presuming what Dave just talked about is the foreplay before this stuff. It's the before foreplay. Now we're getting into things that maybe are happening a little later in that day. First, thoughts and imagination. Thoughts and imagination are taking place here that they imagine. We'll read some more of these, but we'll see that they imagine each other when they're apart. You might wonder, is that okay for me to imagine my wife, or is that called lust too? No, it's lusting after something that's good and something you want and should want. And you can, in a sanctified way, imagine your wife. Imagine what you're going to do. They, in this passage, all through the Song of Songs, they imagine what they're going to do to each other, imagine each other's bodies, and then imagine what they're going to do to each other before they do it. And they also tell each other what they want to do to each other. There's talk involved in it. There's smells involved. Look at chapter 1, verse 3. Smells are right here at the beginning. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfumed poured out. All through the passage, there's talk of different smells going on that is a very sensual smell, apparently. Her appearance is talked about through this passage. Of course, it's talked about in terms of her hair. She's let her hair down. Ron showed us that picture of goats. It's like flowing goats or flowing lambs on the mountain. She's let her hair down. In chapter 4, verse 1, she's wearing a veil, which could be a wedding picture, or it, maybe not. Maybe instead it's that discretion that Dave was talking about, where she's like a dove that's hidden in the cleft of the rock, and she's not too easily drawn out, where there's something of anticipating the bedroom by her being discreet. Like the dove. Look at chapter 6, verse 13. And we'll just be thumbing back and forth over maybe 12 pages in your Bible for the rest of this time here. But look at chapter 6, verse 13. He says, or rather the friends say, I believe, the woman's friends say, come back, O Shulamite, come back that we may gaze on you. The man says, why would you gaze on the Shulamite as on the dance of Mahanaim? We don't know exactly what this dance was, but if it's a dance that people shouldn't be watching, if it's a dance that's not public, this is something of a seductive dance for her husband. And as I said, they talk about what they want to do. Look at chapter 7 in verse 7. Your stature is like that of the palm, the man says, and your breasts are like clusters of fruit. I said, I will climb the palm tree and take hold of its fruit. I imagine you as a tree, and the fruit is hanging, literally, and I want to go and grab it. I want to go and get the fruit. That's part of my goal. And he's saying he's going to do it before he actually does it. Remember in chapter 4, Dave pointed out, chapter 4, verse 6, there's that idea, I want to go all night. You often don't. Maybe it's 2 minutes in heaven. which is better than 1 minute in heaven. They're right about that, sure. But you say sometimes, I want to go all night. I want this to last forever. Okay, that's anticipation of the bedroom. And really, that's just a survey. There's so much more we could do and say about that. Third, notice the words specifically of anticipation and intimacy. The things that lead up to and into the bedroom. Now, think about this. Really, the book of Song of Solomon is a communicating book. It's a book of verbalness. It's a book of communication. Even when you see what they're doing, you know what they're doing in the passage because one of them is saying what they're doing. So whether it's while it's going on or whether it's after I just did that or whether it's before I'm going to do that, I'm going to love you like this, there's so much communication going on. So let's talk about the nature of these words. You might want to write down four things under the nature of the words. They're carefully crafted. They're thoughtful. They're, secondly, vividly descriptive. They're vividly descriptive. They use the word like throughout, about their bodies, about their love. Our love isn't just strong. Our love is strong like this. You're not just beautiful. You're not just pretty. You look pretty. You don't see that in the Song of Songs. You see, you are like this. You are like that. And so it's thirdly symbolic or poetic. And fourthly, it's purposefully exaggerated. So in chapter 4, verse 7, he says of her, there is no flaw in you. Is she really the perfect woman? No. No, I'm sure not. I don't even know what that is. I don't know. It's his perfect woman. And he says, there is no flaw in you. It's purposefully exaggerated. Now, let me talk about the focus of these words and give you four more things. They focus on, number one, the other's appearance. Both of them do this. They talk about what you look like and how beautiful you are and what your parts are like. Secondly, they talk about the other's character or strength or notoriety. She says in chapter 1, verse 16, that he's charming, that he's famous. Thirdly, they focus on the love that they feel for the other person. They describe not just the person, but the love that they feel for that person. My love for you is like, describing the love. And fourthly, they describe the love that they want to express to the other, which we've already talked about, the come, let us do such and such. I want to do this to you. I want to love you like this. I think there's some differences in their words. If you study their speeches and look for what they're emphasizing and not emphasizing, comparing, contrasting, I think you see some slight differences in gender communication here. No surprise, he tends to focus on her body and her beauty in his words of praise. She tends to focus on the nature of their love, the nature of her love for him. It doesn't mean that she never says anything about his body. She has a lot of things to say about his body. You know, his legs are strong. It doesn't mean that she's not interested in the bodily play that's going to happen, the actual sex. No, she's planning it sometimes. She's far from prudish. And it's not just that he's only into parts. He's into her. He's into loving her mind, body, and soul. But on the other hand, he does focus more on her body in his language than she does in hers. And that probably reflects the visual nature of a man's attraction for a woman. We'll come back to that issue if we have the time. Let's talk about her words to him. What does she do? What does she say? She speaks of his desirability, as I said. Chapter 1, verse 3, she says, all the women want you. I got the one that all the women want. I don't know how true it is. I know I did get the woman that a lot of guys wanted, in my opinion. And so I tell that to Sarah sometimes. She speaks of his desirability. She asks him also to take her away. Take me away. Chapter 1, verse 4. Look at it. Chapter 1, verse 4. She says, take me out of here. Take me with you. Let's hurry up. Let the king bring me into his chambers. And if this isn't the king, you got to love it. If this is, like Ron said, maybe a peasant, then you've got to love that she says, my king, take me to your chambers. She speaks of her desire to be with him. She compliments him on his handsome looks, of course, and his charm, as I said. She's public with her praise, though. Look at chapter 2 in verse 8. Chapter 2, verse 8, she says, listen, my lover, look, here he comes. She's not saying this to him. She's saying this to others. Here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. My lover is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look at him bounce. Look at him go. My lover is strong. My lover is energetic. My lover is beautiful. Look also at her praise to her friends about him, praise of him to her friends. Chapter 5 and verse 9. This is after some separation. He goes missing, and if we have the time, we'll talk about that. But he goes missing for a time, and the friends say, we'll help you find him. What does he look like? So, chapter 5, verse 10, my lover is radiant and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. His head is purest gold. His hair is wavy and black as raven. His eyes are like doves by the water streams, washed in milk. Now, here's where you have to think opera. This is not a helpful description if they're really going and looking for him, right? This isn't, here he is, here's a picture. This isn't, well, he's about average height, average thickness. He's got a bit of a pouch. He's got a nasty tattoo that says mom on his neck. You know, these identifying marks we might use in our culture. She doesn't use any of those. It's all symbolism. It's all, as Ron was saying, it's all that extreme language of him being the greatest, which doesn't help their search of the husband at all, but it gives her chance to proclaim what she thinks of him. She's public about her affection. I think that's important. Some women aren't good about this. They don't like PDA, public displays of affection. Or even worse, there's the kind of interaction with your husband in public. Men do this too, but here we're talking about women, where you don't, it's not only that you don't praise him in front of others, you humiliate him in front of others. There is no other anti-Viagra medicine than that. You know what I mean? It's the opposite of Viagra when you humiliate him in front of people. Of course, guys can do that too, and it's just as wrong. It doesn't make sense in where we're going with this. We know what's going to be at the end of this, right? We know it's going to be not just physical, ultimate physical intimacy. It's also going to be emotional and spiritual intimacy as well. But you don't get there. You don't even have a good night in the bedroom with your spouse. If the language hasn't been leading up to it, if there hasn't been anticipation for it, you can't cut 1 minute and then say, how about it, the next. You can. Maybe you do. But it's really functional. Sex then becomes very functional. Her words to him. Let's talk about his words to her. Look at chapter 4, verses 1 through 5. Either Ron or Dave already read this. I'll read it again. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending on Mount Gilead. Your teeth. In chapter 4, verse 3, it's your lips, and then your temples, and your neck, and then your two breasts are like twin fawns of a gazelle. I think that means movement, and they match, which is nice that they match. And then it leads into these verses of, I want to spend all night on this. Notice how slow he went. Well, let me back up and give you five S's related to the man's words to his wife that are here in chapter 4 and then in a couple other places as well apply. He's number one, he's specific. Remember we said, he's not saying, you're pretty. You look nice in that. Now, those are not bad compliments, and some of you need to at least get there, right? You need to move from kindergarten to first grade. William does those kind of comments. Our four-year-old does those kind of comments to Sarah. You're pretty. That looks nice. Your hair is soft. And as I've been studying Song of Songs this week, I've realized that I am not specific enough in my praise. I tend to do four-year-old-like comments with my wife far too often. You look nice. And now I just hear it with a William voice in my head. And I think, no. Be specific. Also, secondly, the second S, use symbolism. Use the word like. Your eyes are like oceans that suck me in and drown me in your love. I just made that off of the top of my head. It's not very good, but my wife has blue eyes and I've used the ocean eye thing before. You need to use like and think of these things. Some of them will come right off the top of your head. Some of them will be bad. Some of them, though, will be bad and she'll still be impressed. We'll come back to that in just a second. Let me go through the S's. Thirdly, he is studious. He studies her. Did you notice, I have in my Bible, in chapter 4, verses 1 through 5, all the parts of her body underlined. Eyes, hair, teeth, lips, temples, neck, then on to breasts. Eyes, hair, teeth, lips, temples. Man, who compliments temples? Your temples are there. And I'm glad for that. That's what would come to my mind. But I'm thinking as I read this, I'm thinking, this dude is camping out. Ron and I have a group of guys we meet with. Some of them are on staff. And we call it our Monday Leadership Training, or MLT, or Meat Lovers Taco, as I sometimes call it. All right, back to point here is that we have been studying how to study the Bible, how to interpret the Bible, and one of the things we came across recently is that studying the Bible is staring at it until things come alive sometimes. It's like the grad student who, you know, meets with his professor for the first day in the lab, and the professor says, all right, I want you to spend the next 15 minutes staring at this fish and writing down all the things you can think of about it. You know, at first he's aggravated, like, hey, you're the expert, you tell me. Just tell me what I got to learn. I don't know. So he writes some things down, the professor comes back and says, that's great, now spend the next half hour looking at it and writing down some more things you see. And again, he gets aggravated, and then the professor comes back the third time and says, great, I want you to spend the rest of the day doing this. And by the end of it, he realizes how much he has seen that he didn't at first see. How much all of a sudden now came to life. That's great for Bible study. It's also great for praising your wife. Just camp out in spots and talk about different parts of her body and her beauty. Fourth, he's slow going. It's related to the above. He's slow going. He studies her and describes her in a very slow going, patient way. It's not two compliments and sex. You're pretty. That's a nice gown. Let's take it off. Done. You know, that's not what's going on here. And lastly, he is intimately sensual in his words, but here's another S that I didn't put in the list. He's smooth about it because he doesn't just start out with those most intimate parts. He begins with eyes and he works down to breasts. We'll see in another passage, he starts at feet and works up to breasts. He seems to like the breasts. But he's not taking shortcuts here, is he? Now let me talk about this, that these carefully crafted words of intimacy need not be brilliant in order to work. Your wife knows you're dumb. My wife knows I'm dumb. So even when you mess up, they can be funny things that that you share and tuck away. I think I said to her once something like, "I love you as much as everything." And I wasn't liquored up either. At the moment, that sounded in my head like, "I love you as much as everything." It means I love everything the same. And you're just one of them. That's horrible. But now it's a joke. And so now that's part of our thing that we share. You know, yeah, it ruined the moment. We hit a 5-minute speed bump there while we laughed. And that's all part of it. It's all good. But sometimes you'll say things that aren't that good. It's not going to be as poetic as the song of songs, but it'll be effort. And she'll know you're making effort. If you've never done anything, think about this. You do anything. If you've never done anything at all in these kind of communication things, you've never made any strides, you've never really tried, you have the 4-year-old compliment vocabulary down pat, but that's it. You've never gone beyond that. Guess what? You make these little advances and she's going to go wild. She's going to like it. It'll work. There's effort. There's also this. They don't always have to come up with new stuff. Interestingly, chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, the one we just saw, chapter 7, verses 5 through 7, go through the same list. Eyes, hair, teeth, temples. Almost the same language. He's only changed a couple of different words. She might be thinking, oh, this is his little poem he has, and he uses it every now and then. And yeah, it seems to be working for them. So it doesn't always have to be new stuff. It can be some of your own stuff repeated. It can be stuff here from Song of Solomon that, as Ron suggested, maybe write your own Song of Solomon's, your own Song of Songs material in your own kind of symbolism. By the way, about this whole communication thing, about them being verbal before they're sexual or even as they're sexual, I try not to see them. But when I've seen sex scenes on TV, you know, the real passionate kind, like you're like, whoa, whoa, you're trying to change it fast enough and you can't get to the remote or whatever. That kind of stuff that we maybe all have seen, maybe you haven't, if not, well done. I have seen some of that. And what I've noticed, I think back about that, they're never talking. Hot Hollywood sex is never verbal. All they do is breathe and sweat and that kind of stuff. They don't talk. This stuff talks. This is verbal because it's intimate. Because it's not just two bodies. These are two souls. So grow in communication. The fourth thing here, and really the thing maybe you came for, is the naked and unashamed bodies. I want to look at 2 or 3 passages in depth. But notice this is a celebration of bodies. Remember I said the man tends to start at the hair and work his way down to the breasts, or in another passage, which we'll see in a minute, he starts at the feet and works his way up to the breasts. Or in just his descriptions, we've already said sometimes men seem to be more interested in appearance than women do. She's talking more about the nature of their love. He's talking more about the nature of her curves. I think that maybe, possibly, some men and some women think that if you focus on her body too much, you're a pervert. And that's what people who go to strippers want. And they're not interested in the soul. And if you're a real gentleman, you won't be interested in parts. You'll be interested in her heart. That's a false dichotomy. It's an overreaction, I think, to what we see in the world, which is parts apart from hearts. That is part of sexuality in the world. but good Protestant, wild, holy sex is a flopping around of bodies. It is it's an exploration of bodies. It's a celebration of bodies. God gave us bodies. He gave us parts. And women, be careful if you find yourself thinking, he only likes me for my breasts. Hopefully that's not the case. But maybe those are windows into your soul that he does enjoy and God has made him to enjoy. Don't be afraid of bodies. Their description of what's going on is not crass, but it's so far from prudish. It's not medical language that you would find in those days. It's not the technical language always, but it's also not some kind of hardcore nastiness either. C.J. Mahaney calls Song of Songs a holy immersion of erotic joy. I almost called this holy eroticism, but I kept thinking, holy eroticism, Batman. So that's why we didn't go with it. Holy eroticism, if you think that that's an automatic contradiction of terms, holy erotic, then that tells us that the world's views of sexuality have so confused us as a church, as Christians, that we think erotic equals dirtiness. When the alternative is not holy lovemaking, which stops in the middle for prayer and devotions, and you know, when it's really good, you give credit to God and point upwards, you know, praise the Lord. No. Holy eroticism is a wonderful way of describing what we're seeing in the Song of Songs. And it means that we need retraining, the retraining of our minds in this area. So here's the first passage under naked and unashamed bodies. It's chapter 6, verse 13. Come back. Come back, O Shulamite. Come back. Come back that we may gaze on you. Why would you gaze on the Shulamite as on the dance? Remember, she dances for him. Probably something like a seductive dance, partly because in chapter 7, verse 1, her feet are in sandals, and that didn't seem to be the norm of those days. She is exposing things that she wouldn't expose in public. That's why the other women shouldn't be watching the dance of the Mahanaim. But she has feet out, and he notices how beautiful they are. Your graceful legs are like jewels, the work of a craftsman's hands. Your navel is a round goblet. Now, like we did in chapter 4 where we highlighted the body parts, let's do this. Just look and see if you can find these words in your text. In chapter 7, verse 1, you have feet, and then you have legs, and then you have navel. And then also in verse 2, you have waist, and then you have breasts, and then you have neck, eyes, nose, head by verse 5. That's a vertical progression, isn't it? You see that? Feet, legs. Except, what's higher, navel or waist? The waist is higher. The navel is higher than the waist. Navel here should not be translated navel. This is not her belly button. It's not her belly button because navels are not goblets of wine. What's wine? Wine is red and wine is wet. This is her vagina. He is moving up a progression from feet to legs to what's also called her garden in chapter 4. So turn back to chapter 4 now. Chapter 4, verse 16. We read already. Remember, her body is the vineyard. Her garden is the inner sanctum. It's her most private of parts. And at the end of verse 16 of chapter 4, she says, let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits. She doesn't say plow the garden like you might think. She says taste of the fruits. And then in chapter 5, verse 1, he says, I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I've gathered my myrrh and my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. You say, Ryan, are you saying what I think you're saying? Yes, I'm saying that. You're saying that's okay? It's here in the Bible. It's here in the Bible. He's tasted of her most intimate of parts and isn't embarrassed about talking about it. Maybe you're okay with that in the bedroom, but you're not okay talking about it. You just kind of, if it happens, it happens. You don't talk. He says what he wants to do. She invites him to do it. I think that also may be going on, by the way, in chapter 2, verse 3, in the reverse direction. Chapter 2, verse 3. Here's another example of why I don't think the wedding has happened in chapter 3. Because in chapter 2, verse 3, she says, like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. Under the shade of the tree, I eat. I taste of his fruit, and it's sweet. Yes, this is in the Bible. We won't go to the third passage that I had in mind. It's too complicated to try to talk about quickly. But let's move to this fifth point in your notes. Growing in confidence, competence, and creativity. Growing in confidence, they're both aggressive through these passages. He's strong. He's no wimp. Dave's right in what he said, of course, about chapter 2 being this initiation. She's a coy dove hiding, and he draws her out, and that's good. But she's also at times willing to initiate. She's the first one speaking in the Song of Songs. The world would say that she talks dirty. And we would say it's not dirty, but it is erotic. It's a shame that the world thinks of certain language not as normal, but as dirty. And we, as Christians, think the same as well. Oh, that's dirty talk. Well, it's very sensual talk. It's very erotic, yes. But it's not dirty. It's beautiful and pure in the marriage bed. And I think she's grown in her sexual confidence. There are some hints of that. In chapter 1, thumb back there, chapter 1, verse 5, she says, I'm dark. I'm lovely. But she says in verse 6, don't stare at me because I'm dark, because I'm darker than by the sun. I'm a worker. What Dave said is that she has alluded to the fact that she hasn't kept up her vineyard, her body very well. She's a worker. Saul, the man is glad she has all her teeth. She may not have been the prettiest girl on the block. But the issue here is not whether she's pretty or not pretty. It's that he thinks she is and she thinks she's not. She thinks she's not. She has these feelings of inadequacy. At least once, maybe twice, she dreams, or he actually does leave. Maybe she dreams twice that he leaves her. She has that feeling of he's going to leave me. He's going to find out I'm just a vineyard worker. He's going to know that I'm not as pretty as he first thought. And yet, we already saw in chapter 6, verse 13, she dances seductively for him. No doubt, she is undressing as she's dancing because things begin to be exposed. In chapter 7, look at this, verse 11. This is great. She's planning a romp. Come, my lover. Let us go to the countryside. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let us go early to the vineyards to see if the vines have budded, if their blossoms have opened, and if the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. She's thinking of new places and maybe even outdoors, arguably. I'm not suggesting that necessarily, because you may get caught and then that would not be a good thing. But this is creative, interesting, thoughtful planning on her part. And of course, it applies to the man as well. But I think it shows you here, this woman is what we would call a wild lover. She pleases her husband. How has she become so confident? No small part of it is that he has been persistent in his compliments and in his commitment to her. Intimacy grows with trust. If intimacy is not just dirty talk, but it's erotic language that also exchanges soul and passion and life and love, not just parts, but parts are no small part of it. If that's the goal, then that's what we call intimacy. Intimacy comes from trust. There's no intimacy apart from trust. That's why intimacy before marriage is so stupid. That's why sex, nonverbal sexual times, are so stupid. It's not intimacy. It's just sexuality. There's no trust there. Guys, tell her how beautiful she is way before the bed. Much. Tell her much before the bed and then in to the bed. Touch her constantly. I know there are women here, because of the culture we live in, where the picture of beauty is plastered all around you, on magazine covers and on the internet, and even people you see that have beauty as an idol, and they're really starving themselves and working out hard to try to keep up that image. I know you sometimes struggle with inadequacy. Now, on the one hand, let me talk to the ladies about this. Ladies, there is nothing more pleasing to your husband than your sexual confidence. There is nothing more gratifying to your husband than for you to be a bold lover. And if you're always talking about how you look, if you're mentioning how bad you look as he's trying to love you, your focus is on you. Your focus is on you and not on him. Part of being a selfless lover as a woman is not thinking about your looks so much. We instead need to give the greatest gift to each other, which is our sexual desire, our passion. He's growing, I think, in competence throughout the passage. You see hints of this. It may take a long time. That's clear. In chapter 2, verse 5, she basically says, we have to stop for a food break. Remember that all night long concept? Lionel Richie dancing on the ceiling all night long. Yeah, they're trying all night long. And she says, I got to have fruit. I need something to get my blood sugar up because I'm about to, oh, I'm so tired. And he's saying, I was done a long time ago. If he's selfish. So men need to grow in their competency to study her and to explore her and to know that your body is not your own, it's hers. And so you're not done until she's done. She takes longer than you do. You need to work on it. Women, I think growing in competence partly means getting relaxed. Don't try to figure out the taxes in your head during lovemaking. Don't do that look off to the side, which is laundry, take kids to soccer, like this, as he's making love and says, is everything okay? And you say, yeah, sorry. It's partly your responsibility, ladies, to get relaxed for lovemaking. Partly your responsibility. Now, men, get her relaxed. Her sexual pleasure is important. Your sexual pleasure is not unimportant. Get her relaxed. Doug Wilson says it like this: many men don't have any comprehension of the demands placed on their wives during the course of the day. Picture a long line of draining and exhausting demands, and they are standing last in line around 10:30 p.m. is her fathead husband with bedroom eyes. You know, doing that. And she's going, you got to be kidding me. When do I get some me time, right? Well, yes, men, get her relaxed. Give her a massage. Read to her. Just get her to calm down. Get her to think about something besides laundry. To go from laundry to, hey, honey, you want to... Not a real smooth transition. Now, I'm not great at this stuff. You know, Wednesday night business time has happened in our home before. No thanks to me. So, I need to improve on this, just like you do, but we need to improve on this and to grow in our competence. We also need to grow in our creativity, which is part of sex itself and what leads up to it. If you always go through the same moves, guys, I always touch kneecap, and then I always touch buttocks, and then I always grab here, and then, I mean, if she could predict it like, all right, here, your hand goes here now, right? And then your hand goes here now, right? If she can do that, then, man, you got to change it up. Same for women, right? We need creativity, as you see through the Song of Songs, different ways, different places, different descriptions of it. The last thing is the goal. Intimacy, oneness, love, serving, and joy. The goal is not sex. The goal is not great sex. The goal is real sex, which is intimate with parts and hearts, you could say. It's a real misnomer to think that you can have great sex without intimacy and oneness and love and serving and pursuing joy. Intercourse should be reconceived for Christians to not mean the intercourse of parts, but the intercourse of body and soul. In serving our spouse, we serve ourselves. Sometimes we serve selflessly in the bedroom. What I mean by that is this. Sometimes he wants it and you don't. And you can say, oh, I have a headache. Not tonight. I think I'm catching a cold. You don't want to get it, do you? The kids might come in. You know that kind of thing? Now, there's some kind of selfless sex that's not very good. Let me give you a grade, and maybe you want to think about these, or just jot some notes down to see where you might fit in on this grading scale, if I can find it in my notes, because I've been here, there, and everywhere in this message. All right, I'll wing it. Here's my grading scale. A is cloud nine, blow your mind, that kind of thing. It's home run, fireworks stuff. B, giving yourself a B on this grading scale, is love-serving sex that wasn't a home run. A man desires to please his wife, and it's hard to get there. It's not that night, okay? There's that kind of, I want to serve you, I want to love you. Just give me the roadmap. Show me where to go. Show me what to do. I'll do it. I'll do it for hours if you want, whatever you want. She goes, I love you. It's okay. I just, not tonight. And that's not abnormal, I don't think. C, if you're grading, is, I call it medicinal sex. I'm leaving to go out of town tomorrow on a business trip. It doesn't matter if we got headaches, we got colds. We are having sex that night, right? My wife will be as persistent on that issue as I am. She wants me going a free man, if you know what I mean. She wants me going released. She wants me going and not having struggles when I'm outside of the country for a week or so. So there's medicinal sex. And then D is selflessness in sex. It's, I call them, I got mine, you get your orgasms. I got mine, you get your orgasms. Kind of, I did my thing. If you can get it, great, do it. If not, well, we're done. And then F is just pure selfishness and sexual frustration. It's either no sex or it's weird sex. We don't expect home runs every time at the plate, but we want to pursue love and humility and patience. We want to bear the fruit of the Spirit in the marital bed. One of those is joy. And one of those is long-suffering. All right, we'll stop there. Let me pray.